Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host today, Carl Nellis, and I'm talking with Scott Salisker, who's assistant professor of English at the University of Arizona, and we're talking about his new book, Human Programming, Brainwashing, Automatons, and American Unfreedom. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl, and thanks so much for having me.
I'm delighted to have you on to talk about the research that you've done really across a century's worth of storytelling and discussion and discourses about human automatons, and to explore what you have done in bringing those pieces together. Before we jump into the book, can you talk a little bit about what brought you to this field, to this project, what spurred your interests, and then maybe a little bit about the process of researching and writing this book?
Sure, thanks. This is a project I've been working on for some time, really since about 2005. And that was a moment when I was, you know, in graduate school and noticing a lot of public discourse about brainwashing. It was, American Taliban soldier John Walker Lind had been captured in 2002, and media outlets were talking about him and giving interviews about him as having been brainwashed. And in the years following, more and more narratives about brainwashing kind of came back. For instance, Jonathan Demme remade The Manchurian Candidate, and also, Fox News and MSNBC were relatively new presences on cable networks. And you heard a lot of sort of back and forth between increasingly partisan political scene where people on the left and on the right called each other brainwashed. So I got really interested in both the history of that idea and in its kind of functions in the public sphere, how it got used to describe people who seem to hold an idea that would be sort of unthinkable and even literally unthinkable if you have to be brainwashed in order to hear it. So I got interested in that idea, and over the course of dissertation research and turning it into a book, I wound up with a kind of longer and bigger story about it. The first development was realizing that brainwashing is kind of attached to a particular literary figure that I call the human automaton, film and literature kind of between high literature and science fiction often stage these encounters with a being that seems to be maybe a real person or maybe a robot or maybe a real free-thinking person or maybe someone who's been brainwashed. So I looked at that figure, and you know, the kind of literary history of that figure is maybe the kind of anchor through the book. But the book wound up being structured as a kind of story about how we think about American freedom versus either totalitarian or communist or fundamentalist unfreedom. As I looked at the different kinds of uses of brainwashing discourse and of this human automaton figure, both in literature and in the social sciences and public discourses, we talked about totalitarians, communists, cult members, and then fundamentalists using the same kind of toolkit of images of sort of unfreedom.
As you begin the book with the introduction, you do start with John Walker Lind, and then you also set out what the book is intending to do over the course of this literary history, which really becomes a cultural history. I really appreciate the extent to which you engage all kinds of discourses. You know, it's a literary history, but it's literary history in the sense that it engages news narratives, and it engages political discourse, and it engages scientific discourse. And so in that way, it's truly interdisciplinary in a way I really appreciate. Can you talk a little bit about how you moved from maybe what would be considered a traditional literary history to doing what looks more like a cultural studies?
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of my background, I had an English and comp lit undergraduate degrees. And when I got to graduate school, I was really interested in American studies as a field and a kind of paradiscipline, maybe. And so as I wound up, writing a dissertation that was a more traditionally literary dissertation, I kept thinking that I kept seeing the things I was writing about in other kinds of discourse. And for me, I like to think of it as a good literary criticism study, kind of thinking about the ways that literature and film, both are kind of equally in the book, have a kind of footprint all across the culture. So a book like 1984 kind of gets into America. It's a Book of the Month Club right after it's released in 1949. And then the images of, the 2 minutes hate, of Doublethink, of Newspeak, this kind of cluster of ideas and images just goes everywhere in American culture. It's it gets name-checked in sociological studies, in political theory, in psychiatrists' book about what's wrong with things today. And so, that kind of footprint of a set of sort of fundamentally literary and cinematic images kind of going everywhere in culture was really exciting to me. And so the book wound up telling a story about literature and science and politics in a way that the exchanges between them wound up being really ultimately omnidirectional. Sometimes science fiction writers would be taking up what scientists or political theorists or political thinkers were doing. And sometimes it would be totally the other way around.
Well, and one of the things I appreciate about the introduction is that it gives a strong and clear sense of some of those mechanisms. So you do say many different ways, but you also demonstrate what I would consider a pretty strong model of culture, where you're saying this book is literary and cultural history that demonstrates how we get the metaphor, the figure of the automaton. But then you also say, then in turn, this is the history of how the figure of the automaton shapes American ideas about the self and the other and freedom and unfreedom. So you're talking both about how a culture generates figures or metaphors or ideas, and then how those ideas in turn shape the culture. And so I thought the way that you set that out in the introduction is really helpful and clear. So some of the other things that you do in the introduction are you pull in thinkers that you'll be working with, whose methods or whose key terms you borrow. And then you talk a little bit about some of the more concrete pieces of the metaphor or the figure of the automaton. So can you maybe talk a little bit about how, as you're setting up theoretically, you address the ideas of Foucault and Rancière and Latour who come back throughout the book?
Sure. Absolutely. I think maybe, in some ways, Latour, gives me a sort of model for what I want to do. And, he's a sociologist and in a recent book says that his kind of model for what a good sociological study should do is to trace a network, to kind of assume that all of the players that you see in the field before you are kind of on equal footing, and that what you ought to do is look for all the different ways you can find that they connect to each other. So that gives me, or that gave me a kind of way of thinking about literature and film and the social sciences and political theory and public discourse kind of on the same footing without assuming, that science is the bad guy and that literature is going to sort of critique all the bad things that happen in the world, and that's going to be the only relationship between the two.
Right.
So that aspect from Latour really gave me a kind of model to work with. And I'd say that, you know, within American studies and also literature and science, someone like Priscilla Wald, who wrote a book about contagion and the ways that we tell stories about outbreaks. That was, for me, a kind of similar model of kind of telling a story about these really omnidirectional interchanges between literary culture, scientific culture, and the news media. So that would be that's another, I think, kind of debt for me. And those two books, I think, kind of gave me the model for what I want to talk about. And with Foucault, actually, Latour gives me a way of kind of, well, ultimately talking about brainwashing in a way that doesn't just totally depend on Foucault's sort of docile body and panopticon and so forth, which is, you know, kind of how brainwashing has been talked about in academic discourse before. If you use that model of sort of this is how power operates, and, you know, ideology in Althusser kind of interpolates the subject. You come up with a model where, well, brainwashing is an example of that, but then you don't have anything left to say. So Latour and Wald's and other literature and science work helped me to get a kind of more supple relationship in those. And then Rancière comes in as I start to think about the question of community. Rancière has some really, I think, compelling ideas about what democracy is and what a kind of political action looks like. And he describes you know, democracy in terms of counting. Who counts you know, as a voter, which is certainly a relevant topic these days. Who counts in a democracy, and who do we allow to count? And he winds up saying that, you know, our perception of the world, of what's kind of considered proper, or what the what we consider to be natural divisions, sort of influences and shapes how we understand who counts in a democracy. So, you know, when you look at the image of the brainwashed John Walker Lind, or the brainwashed Brody in Homeland, which I also wind up talking about in the book, you get someone who obviously can't count, right? You have someone who, well, they're not free thinking, so they can't be part of a democracy. And so I got really interested in this idea that, you know, we imagine democracy to be, you know, founded on freedom and in many good and useful ways. But then that led me to investigate, what do we think unfreedom is? What do we, how do we decide who doesn't count and whose ideas don't count? And, you know, we saw examples of that during, say, the Red Scare or McCarthyism and in other kind of historical moments where we imagine that certain ideas could only be sort of brainwashed into people.
And another piece of how you locate that idea is you talk about, in the introduction, ideas of the human as being between a kind of animal, brute, beast on one side, and then machine or kind of automaton on the other, and kind of a wholly embodied, where the human gets absorbed into a bodily nature, or kind of wholly disembodied, just kind of a detached mind. Can you talk a little bit about how you deal with that network of ideas in the introduction?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. That's, you know, I wound up sort of trying to engage with the intellectual history of exclusion, and thinking about how the history of race affected, especially early in the 20th century, how we understand who counts in a democracy, how we think about who's really fully human. So there's a lot of terrific work about the first half of the 20th century and the roles of eugenics in a sort of imagining a kind of hierarchy of the races and a kind of relationship between people and animals. Dana Seidler's work, Dale Ann English's, Walter Ben Michael's, all thinking about this history of exclusions based on ultimately white supremacy that's sort of shored up by science. That was a narrative where this kind of continuum between people and animals, what Dana Zeitler calls atavism, sort of structures the ideas about who counts. Mm-hmm. And what struck me is that as sharp and useful as those histories are, and as applicable, unfortunately, as they are for current, for kind of present day, say, white supremacists, the kind of mainstream of political and scientific culture after World War II really doesn't deal in eugenics anymore. You know, we open up the camps at the end of World War II. We see that we sort of understand, we come to understand the Nazi project as a project of eugenics, and we distance ourselves from that as a culture at large. And we wind up with a really different kind of scene for propaganda, for nationalism, for thinking about what makes democracy. So we have this kind of globally expanding democracy after World War II as America takes a kind of bigger role on the world stage. And we have an enemy that's no longer explainable in terms of their racial characteristics anyway. We're not fighting a particular country, we're fighting communism after World War II, right? And so you can't represent a communism as just a kind of a set of physical characteristics. But even starting during World War II, when people like Eric Fromm were writing about what totalitarianism is, they light on this image of what Eric Fromm calls the human automaton, a kind of a person who's reduced to a sort of machine. And that image, and this is kind of the main narrative of my book, that image really takes hold across the political spectrum. You have it getting kind of applied on both the left and the right and in the center during this period, sort of between World War II and the present. And so instead of imagining people as kind of on a continuum with animals in public discourse and propaganda, you have brainwashing, right? You have this set of ideas about what either institutions or propaganda or even like brainwashing and POW camps can do to like mess up the human brain in a way that makes it more like a machine. And of course, at the mid-century, we're also at a moment where we're sort of starting to imagine computers, and so we're thinking more in terms of the mind's resemblance to a computer than we are of the kind of organisms, the human organism's relationship to the animal. So yeah, that winds up being a kind of structuring historical narrative, you know, in broad strokes, that kind of gives me a spot to start in right during World War II that says, hey, we're imagining something totally different about, you know, who belongs and who doesn't in this moment.
And the way that you use the image of marching soldiers in World War II propaganda on both sides is really interesting. I think does some great work there in setting that up. And then as you use Erich Fromm to transition into Cold War and the first chapter, you then talk about how Orwell picks up on a certain kind of programming through language. And then, as you said earlier, that becomes a major piece of what gets understood as a human automaton. And you put Orwell in a really interesting conversation with Hannah Arendt. Can you talk about what's going on with Orwell and language in particular that gets picked up and attached to ideas of totalitarianism and automatons?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, in the past month or so, I've thought a lot about Orwell, who I think is just an absolutely relevant figure for us, for thinking about public discourse, for thinking about misinformation, the kind of, I don't know, fatigue and dread associated with hearing 2 + 2 = 5 sort of over and over again.
Right.
But in the book, I wind up taking a sort of a narrower approach to Orwell, where I think about his interest in newspeak. Orwell was a big fan of kind of a progressive language change policy, right? He has that famous essay, Politics in the English Language, that, you know, English composition instructors are still assigning, right?
yep.
Where he's talking about sort of ridding your mind of cliches and not to say things without thinking through the image. And so he'll come up with an image like the fascist octopus has sung its swan song and says, like, no, like, you can't use metaphors and sort of set phrases in this unthinking way. And, you know, it's still useful composition essay, but it's also an essay about what Orwell thinks is really thinking and how important Orwell thought really thinking was to democracy. And, you know, that's, I think, just an absolutely key point. And so he, in that Politics in the English Language essay, describes, I think he says, that, you know, actually thinking will be the first step in political regeneration. So he really means it. He means the politics part. And in 1984, that same kind of idea comes directly into newspeak. One of Winston Smith's first kind of rebellions in the novel is he encounters a person who he calls a quack speaker, which it was great rereading the novel and finding this delightful quack speaking and duck speaking. But it's someone who only speaks in orthodoxy, someone who he says that they're not even speaking with their brain, they're speaking with their larynx. So this idea that, you know, orthodoxy can be absorbed and then just kind of chirped back at people. So he winds up, I think, in 1984, thinking really seriously about that possibility. So when Orwell was having the book published in America, and it was going to be a new, Book of the Month Club book. They told him, yeah, we like everything, but let's take out the appendix on newspeak to make it more reader friendly. And he refused. He risked a fair amount of money on absolutely insisting that this appendix on newspeak be part of the book. And so, through it, he's thinking, he has an example where he says, oh, well, the Comintern if you just say Comintern, you don't have to think about the fact that it's a communist international. And this seems like this kind of intensification of his point to an almost absurd level. Like you do, because you're only saying three syllables instead of what, six or seven, you won't have time to stop and think. But that stopping and thinking is really important to him. And so he imagines Newspeak in Oceania as a kind of technology of propaganda that's even more a kind of intense than news propaganda, than misinformation. So he wants to imagine a language where if you don't have the words, then you won't be able to think critically. Right. And, you know, that is something that pops up in Hannah Arendt's work as well, when she describes Adolf Eichmann's personality, the kind of architect of the Holocaust who goes on trial in the early 60s. Arendt's there to report on it, and she sees him in the courtroom, and she sees him talking, and she sees him as precisely a duck speaker. She says that he only thinks in Amtssprache, official ease, and he thinks only in cliches. And that's the thing that keeps him from thinking critically. So it's an interesting kind of historical point to me. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I quite buy into, you know, linguists call this the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Right. That, you know, your language constrains what you're able to think. I'm not sure I buy it quite on the face of it, in all the particulars. But historically, it's fascinating because it gives it's this moment where critical thinking is such an important thing for both Orwell and Arendt to try to figure out where is it. We have to find it. We need it for like democracy in the world, and so they look for it precisely in language.
Well, and one of the ways that you set that up is by talking about how much that picks up on behaviorist psychology, and particularly Watson. Absolutely. And this is one of the places where you begin the really the cross-pollination or the omnidirectional movement of ideas between science and psychology in particular, and literature and political discourse. Can you just talk a little bit more about the connection between Watson's ideas and behavioral psychology and how it gets to Orwell?
Oh, yeah. So Orwell, this is a kind of interesting little miniature, like case study and miniature of that omnidirectionality, because Orwell, in his kind of climactic scene of 1984, the one where Winston gets tortured by the with the rats in his face, he borrows that from John B. Watson, who is the kind of American founder of behaviorist psychology. Pavlov, who's, of course, better known mostly through anti-Russian propaganda, is doing similar work in the USSR at the time. But Watson winds up coming up with this sort of full program for psychology, and it's, you know, in some sort of subfields and in some kinds of practice, behaviorism is still useful today, with, say, treatments of severe autism and so forth. But Watson wants to think about the mind kind of from the outside. He says that, you know, all of the psychology that's come before him is unscientific because it's not based on observable things. So the thing you can observe about someone is their behaviors. And so like Pavlov's dogs, the salivation is this kind of involuntary reflex that they're examining with that. And Watson kind of keeps on with this program, and B.F. Skinner, one of his disciples, sort of continues it through the middle of the century. And in Skinner's verbal behavior, there's this kind of set of really pretty radical ideas that, you know, if we're going to think of everything as a behavior, as something that's a habit, as something that can be learned, and as something that could be potentially conditioned or unlearned, Skinner says, well, you know, our words are behaviors too. And of course, that's not so far from what someone like the later Wittgenstein would say. Mm-hmm. And so he starts describing all of our words as kind of habits of thought. And that's precisely what Orwell does in 1984 as well. In the appendix in Newspeak, he talks mm-hmm. about the habits of thought that are associated with individual words. So he'll say, I'll forget the exact words, examples he uses, but he says, oh, well, you know, these ideas like freedom, democracy, and individuality, something like that, will get kind of banished by Newspeak in the same way that, you know, the pagan gods like Moloch and Baal and Osiris are in the Bible, right? That there's this way of just kind of throwing out old ways of thinking with old words. And of course, this that Skinner book gets famously savaged in a review by Noam Chomsky after it comes out. That was kind of right at the beginning of Chomsky's career. That set of ideas where all of our, you know, all of our behaviors are habits, all of our most cherished thoughts are something that we've been taught and something that we might have been taught totally differently. That gets to be a really worrisome problem for someone like Orwell, who's imagining, you know, what this new geopolitical phenomenon of the totalitarian state might be capable of if allowed to flourish.
Yeah. And then you kind of transition into a historical mode, and you have a section of chapter one on the brainwashing scare. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on there historically?
To finish, or to kind of tie back to that omnidirectionality of exchange with Orwell. Orwell borrows Watson's scene and indirectly, I think, arrives at ideas that look a lot like Skinner's. And then Orwell's 1984 gets into the hands of a CIA operative named Edward Hunter, who credits him with helping him come up with the idea of brainwashing. Edward Hunter's the operative who coins this term around 1950 or 1951. Mm-hmm. So historically, at this moment, you know, Orwell's written just after the end of World War II, and Hunter is a correspondent working for the CIA in Mao's China. So he, Chairman Mao has just taken power, and, you know, the Americans are obviously worried, you know, with China becoming a communist country. And so he goes and investigates what's happening in the new communist state. And, you know, Mao had a sort of regime of thought reform, of kind of government re-education. And so Hunter goes on to describe, you know, how like the government school that you have to go to in order to get a government job works. And he calls this brainwashing. You know, people are being exhausted in these schools and sort of re-educated with Marxist principles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that book hits and it gives a name to something we hadn't talked about or described before. But it really takes off as a term after the end of the Korean War. So in 1953, get back about 7,000 American POWs. And the New York Times reported that about a third of them had collaborated in some way with their captors. There had been there had been American prisoners on the radio reporting that the Americans had been doing germ warfare in Korea. And then there were 21 soldiers who, when they were released at the end of the Korean War, decided not to even repatriate. They decided to stay in Korea. And this was, you know, a huge like PR problem, right? Like, yes. How could it be thinkable for these people to agree with the communists, agree with their communist captors more than with their American home of democracy and freedom? So that's when the term brainwashing really takes off. It gets used in the news media to describe these dissenting soldiers of various degrees. Hunter will go on to write another book, Brainwashing and the Men Who Defied It, to describe a little bit. Nobody ever really says exactly what the techniques of mind control are, but they all imagine that they're going to be there. So Hunter's doing all of that. And then a number of military and scientific figures start writing in like the Saturday Evening Post or write books about brainwashing and the threat to America, right? If the communists are developing technologies to, say, use drugs and hypnosis and so forth to really reprogram humans, then we have to be on our guard about it. So a number of, a dozen or so books and around, say, 50 articles in newspapers and magazines are devoted to this problem of brainwashing. And it gives us a kind of version of the Cold War that then gets fought at home, right? We have to be on our guard against these brainwashers or infiltrators in America. So it's very much a part of kind of anti-communist McCarthyist sentiment in the 1950s in particular.
And then you close out the chapter with a really interesting reading of The Manchurian Candidate. You then talk about how those kind of postures toward totalitarianism in the figure of the automaton gets picked up, maybe in a way that would seem unlikely, but gets picked up by the new left in the 60s and 70s, and that which is totalitarian and that which brainwashes becomes domestic institutions here in America that need to be resisted, and their totalitarian power needs to be resisted, and people need to keep from becoming automatons in the service of American institutions at home. Can you talk about maybe some of the texts that you read there and really how you pull together that historical picture of that moment?
Sure. Yeah. And this was, that was the part of the book that wound up sort of coming in last into this bigger story that I was telling, in part because it was the most unexpected. But when I was, as I say, kind of tracing the network, trying not to, trying to minimize the number of assumptions I was going to make, especially about the political valences of this figure. It's one that we assume is kind of a right-wing sort of scare tactic. I wound up seeing it a lot in progressive texts and, You know, Ken Kesey's One for the Cuckoo's Nest is maybe my favorite example, because there's actually a really kind of very close tie to the brainwashing discourse, which is Randall Patrick McMurphy is this kind of all-American rebel figure who gets himself locked up in an asylum. He's trying to get out of a work assignment on a prison stint. And he rebels against the institution and the big nurse who's running the ward. And ultimately, she defeats him. But it's kind of a story about kind of American defiance against this kind of a total institution, this kind of deadening force that is the, say, the man or the establishment, or in the mm-hmm. the novel, he calls it the combine, because it's like it's this weird institution where it's not just the ward, but it's, you know, capitalism and institutions and like corporations and just kind of like all the bad things lumped into this sort of total institution that is society. Mm. So Kesey writes this story about Randall Patrick McMurphy, and I was really surprised rereading the novel to find that McMurphy has a backstory that he talks about at one point, and it says, you know, he was a POW in Korea, and mm-hmm. he led a prison revolt against the communists. And it made me realize that Kesey is very explicitly kind of flipping around that brainwashing discourse. He's mm-hmm. imagining that this kind of American, this essentially American free personality, is a progressive one and is, mm-hmm. You know, the one that is our only hope against this kind of deadening force of institutions and asylums and bureaucracy and so forth. So Kesey, you know, is associated with the New Left, but in interviews throughout his life, I don't think this made it into the book, he always talks about his novels as anti-totalitarian. Mm-hmm. Like he wants his novels to fight totalitarianism. So in my book, I wind up sort of looking at McMurphy as a figure, as this kind of reclaimed progressive figure. And I think about how that kind of gets legs in the American mid-century and 60s and 70s, and how, you know, some really, I think, rhetorically masterful writers use the set of images of human automatons toward their own ends. And so Ralph Ellison in Invisible Man makes this kind of total institution, the factory hospital and the Communist Party that winds up betraying Harlem in mm-hmm. In his novel, and does so through a kind of automaton figures. And Betty Friedan in The Feminine Mystique describes the household as a comfortable concentration camp in a, you know, very uncomfortable image, and describes the housewife as being reduced to an anonymous biological robot. What all of these figures are doing, I think, is to take this anti-totalitarian image of the human automaton and kind of flip it around and use a kind of universally shared anti-totalitarian sentiment in America as a kind of rhetorical leverage point for advancing their own agendas. I found that a really unexpected but fascinating part of the research that I did.
And in the next chapter, you take that work and that history and you really engage the contributions of cybernetics as a discipline. And you start to talk about a couple of really key aspects today of how we're thinking about what's an automaton, what's a human automaton. And you start to address ideas of what is human labor and things like techno-orientalism and multiculturalism versus fundamentalisms that become a piece of the rest of the book. Could you maybe dive into those three? Because this is, I think, what I read as the heart of the book, this chapter on computation and emotion and posthumanism. So can you hit on labor and that aside on techno-orientalism, and then how you come to an analysis of what's going on with the automaton figure between multiculturalism and fundamentalism?
Sure. In this chapter, I wind up looking at really the birth of the computer and cybernetics, and a kind of a set of questions about what it is that makes us human. And I think that the developments of robotics and cybernetics and computation made us think differently about that. Mm-hmm. Norbert Wiener, who I think we should all be reading more of, he's fascinating, visionary figure. In 1947, goes to the AFL-CIO and says, "Hey guys, you know that like so many of these like great union jobs are about to be replaced by machines, and it's going to devalue labor, and things are going to be really bad for you. We need to figure out how to make a different strategy for you guys and for America." And he, foresees a problem that's, you know, a major, and, you know, even in this past election where people have been talking about the Rust Belt and deindustrialization, automation has been a huge factor in that, in addition to outsourcing. But Wiener winds up, after he, says that, well, the AFL-CIO listened to me, but then we couldn't figure out what to do next. Winds up thinking about kind of the human and the machine, I think, in really fresh ways. So I look in that chapter at kind of the influence of ideas about computation on, particularly science fiction. This is the chapter of the book where, gosh, it could have been a lot longer dealing with a lot more science fiction. I had to kind of rein myself in. But I look at, say, Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep as a text that's really thinking about emotion. If we imagine that the difference between a human and a machine is the ability to feel, then that whole book and Blade Runner based on Do Androids Dream is just systematically picking apart, you think you know what feelings are. In fact, you don't. There are all of these different components to what a feeling is. Some of them are physiological, some are conscious, some are cultural and moral. So I kind of explore how that question about the difference between a human and a machine develops in surprising and unexpected ways in the mid-century. And as it kind of gets back to my main narrative, I think about the question of the self and the other as it often gets expressed there. And we see, Greta New and her co-authors of a really useful volume on techno-orientalism do a really smart job of tracing how our ideas about technology are often part of, kind of racist images of Asians and Asian Americans. And so they trace this set of images where Asians and Asian Americans are imagined as robotic and as sort of not as unfeeling, and so again kind of inhuman. So I borrow from them this kind of idea of techno-orientalism, and then in a step that like the very last step of that chapter is to look at a really interesting novel called Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, where he winds up envisioning this kind of cybernetic and very emphatically multicultural future. There's like a it's a book written in the early 90s, and there's Russian fuzz grunge music, and there's like a Japanese rapper, and the protagonist of the story is half Japanese and half African American. And so thinking about how our ideas about multiculturalism feed into techno-orientalism, I realized, well, not every image of Asians and Asian Americans is quite like that. But in Snow Crash, what we find in this moment right after the Cold War is over is Stevenson sets up a kind of divide between this cast of multicultural and often kind of cyborg characters. There are a lot who are kind of machine-human hybrids in various ways. But there are ones who are free-thinking and kind of a part of this democratic global multiculturalism. And then there are fundamentalists, these people who've been programmed and brainwashed. And so where the free people in this novel have all kinds of different bodies, raced bodies and mechanical bodies, the thing that the novel like makes into the enemy is anything with a mechanical mind and that can't be free thinking. And so that sort of feeds back into the overall narrative of the book. Where Stevenson has taken a lot of elements in very different ways, but now has, instead of sort of American versus totalitarian or communist divide, instead it's one between a kind of pluralist multiculturalism and then a sort of mechanically envisioned fundamentalism.
So I think at this point we're going to have to leap over the cult programming chapter, leave that for readers to explore. And the final chapter is on terrorist consciousness.
Yeah.
And ways that brainwashing and human automatons have been ideas that have been used in attempting to understand what is American freedom and what is unfreedom in the 21st century and in the era of the war on terror and coming up to the present. Can you talk a little bit about how you engage that, some of the texts you've used, and how you see really the lines you've been developing, the cultural model you've been developing, how you bring that into the present?
Yeah, I wound up writing that first and then realizing that our sort of sociological and psychological understandings of cults winds up kind of feeding into that. So mm-hmm. people like Patty mm-hmm. Hearst and Ted Patrick, who are fascinating, wind up kind of giving a prehistory to, you know, this set of discourses about fundamentalism and terrorism in the present.
Yes.
So I look at the beginning of that chapter at all, you know, a kind of a cluster of ideas and discourses that we have about the terrorist. There have been smart arguments about, for instance, terrorists, Islamic terrorists, especially being kind of this medieval figure mm-hmm. That we imagine that as part of the past. And then the legal scholar Letty Volpe talks about this kind of ambiguous racial category that gets developed of the Arab Muslim a kind of hybrid figure that gets developed in profiling after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And then in what I see as kind of a complement to those, our descriptions, especially when we look at the consciousness, at the ideas of the fundamentalist, we often keep returning to this idea of brainwashing. And that's what we have in the John Walker Lind case. And it's also what we get in a number of really interesting texts from the past decade and a half that sort of engage with the idea, with the question of what the terrorist is thinking. So I look at Don DeLillo's Falling Man in the kind of literary category, and then actually two television shows, which are just as interesting, if not more, the early seasons of Homeland, which seems to be based loosely off of John Walker Lind in some ways, and also the science fiction show Battlestar Galactica. And so all of these texts are, you know, interested in this kind of impossible problem of how do we understand someone who's like thinking the unthinkable? How do we we don't exactly want to sympathize with the terrorist, but we want to be able to understand them as something, as like human, as something that's not this kind of Cold War era dialectic of free self and unfree other that I've seen that I kind of traced through the rest of the book. I look to like Battlestar Galactica and DeLillo's novel and Homeland at this kind of set of strategies for trying to break down this kind of self versus other mentality, or this kind of unbridgeable divide that we see in public discourse about the sort of free self and the brainwashed other, whether that's an American self, a free American democratic self and a fundamentalist other, whether it's a left-wing or right-wing self and the appropriate other, or what have you.
There's so much more in the book that we just can't fit into an hour because of how rich your research is and your writing. The way that you engage ideas of American individualism is really complex and compelling. How you hit on ideas about which bodies matter and how you engage Donna Haraway's work in really interesting detail, and how you engage even things like advertising and Apple's 1984 ad. Really interesting.
It's one of my favorite parts.
I hope that that listeners will really go out and engage with your work, because I think you're doing something that's important and interesting and can really help us to discuss ways that we understand each other today. So thanks so much for writing the book and for coming on the show. Before you go, can you tell us a little bit more about maybe what you're doing now and what we might expect to come next from you?
Sure. And man, thanks again for having me. This has been a lot of fun. I'm working now. My conclusion to the book sort of says, like, well, if we, you know, have this idea of like sublime freedom versus sublime unfreedom in so many texts, might there be a kind of way around this image? And so I describe the network and the social network as a kind of analytical tool to start with that. So I've started a new book on social networks, and actually published an article about it that describes the Bechdel test, that kind of popular film thing, as a kind of set of ideas about networks of characters and sort of where and how we look for the space to be an individual, both in the world and in text. So that's where I'm headed next.
We'll keep an eye out for that. Scott, again, thanks so much for joining us on New Books in Intellectual History.
Thank you, Carl.